Hello and welcome. You're listening to podcast 3 for the lecture on heuristic search. We resume on slide 40. And we want to look at how we can design actually good heuristic functions. So we've seen that the informedness of a heuristic is critical for the success of the search algorithm. We want our heuristic to help us to expand promising states that lead us as directly as possible to the goal states first. And we also want the heuristic to help us to recognize dead ends early, not only when we are in a dead end state and then have to backtrack all the way up to another branch of the search space. And of course, under practical conditions, we wanted to at least find near optimal solutions or even better optimal solutions if we have a consistent heuristic. To design good heuristic functions, we need a good understanding of the application domain. We want to keep heuristic and search approach separate. So on the one hand, we select a specific search algorithm, and we've seen already a number of candidates so far, and we want to be able to actually try our algorithms, maybe even with different heuristics. So that's why we look at the design of the heuristic function completely independently of the search approach that we later want to follow. We can try out different variants in empirical tests, but we cannot really have so far a design approach that gives us a really good heuristics. So this is still a kind of art form, and it's also a hot topic in AI research, how we can design good heuristics functions. Later in this lecture, we will also learn about, for example, the design of heuristics in AI planning, and this shows you what different techniques can be used. In the following, I want to give you some basic examples. So let's look back at the game that we looked at in the beginning. So our idea in the eighth puzzle is just to consider the moves of the empty cell. But nevertheless, we have up to four possible options, and the question is which one we should pick. So we can now look at this little game and application and think about possible heuristics. For example, one idea that one can come up with is that we count the number of tiles that are in the wrong position. This is called the misplaced tiles heuristic. So this gives us an idea of how many tiles have to change their position such that we can actually reach the goal. This heuristic is easy to compute. However, it does not tell us anything about the effort that we need to invest to move a tile from its current cell to the cell where it should be in the goal state. So somehow we would also like to be able to estimate this effort. And as we are here in a grid world, it makes sense to take, for example, the so-called Manhattan distance. So we calculate the length of the path that, or the shortest path from a current position to a goal position. Let's look, for example, at tile 6. Tile 6 is in the middle of the right-hand row, and we need to move it, for example, one position down and three positions to the left to actually bring it to its goal state position. So let's look on slide 42 what these two heuristics compute. So the value of H1 for this little situation is 8. All tiles are misplaced and in the wrong position. The value for H2 is now the sum of all these Manhattan distances for all the tiles. So for example, for slide 7, we have the value of 2 plus 1. So we need to shift two positions down, one position to the right, It's three. For tile two, the difference is one. For slide four, the difference is two. One position down, one position to the side. So overall, this leads a value of 18. Yeah, you see also here below these the equation that we actually use for the Manhattan distance. Of course, the disadvantage of the Manhattan distance is that it considers all tiles independently. But in this game, once we move one tile, other tiles also have to move as well. So now we can actually run empirical comparison of both heuristics. So on slide 43, you see some experiments, you see different algorithms. And in particular, you see A star, how it uses the two heuristics. D is the distance from the goal. So we start with an initial state configuration, for example, where we need to make two moves to find the goal state, 4, 6, and so on. And you can actually see that the heuristic H2 is much more informative. So it helps A star to expand significantly fewer states to find the optimal solution. And this is also caused by the effective branching factor that the algorithm encounters then in the search space. However, we can do even better. So on slide 44, here's another heuristic, the so-called linear conflict heuristic. So what is a linear conflict? So we have given two tiles, J and K, and they are in a linear conflict if they are on the same line. The goal positions are in this line, but they are somehow flipped. So we need to flip these tiles, and this means, of course, they have to travel around each other. So, in fact, the linear conflict heuristic will add a cost of two moves for each pair of conflicting tiles to the Manhattan distance, because these tiles need to surround one another. I leave this to you as an exercise to compute some more values of the linear conflict heuristic and maybe play by hand through a few expansions to see how it influences the behavior of A star. So the linear conflict heuristic is in fact a consistent heuristic for this little game, and it's also more informative than the Manhattan distance because it takes into consideration these conflicting pairs in addition to the Manhattan distance, and that's why it has a more accurate estimate for the true costs. Another heuristic is shown on slide 45. This is Gaschnik's heuristics. It uses a different representation for this game, where we actually take strings to encode a state. So the number 9 stands for the blank, and otherwise we have the numbers 1 to 8, and we go through the grid line by line and somehow depict the state by this number. So you see actually that we need to transform the number starting with 7, 2, blah blah blah, ending in 3, 1, to a number that is starting with 9, 2 and ending in 7, 8. So now we can actually define a so-called relaxed move. Any tile can be moved to the blank position, and we count the number of swaps, and we loop until we find a solution. So here's the little algorithm that we actually do. So if 9 is not at the first position where it should be, then we swap 9 with the element whose target position 9 is taking. Else, we swap 9 with the rightmost element that is not in its proper place. So you see actually how this heuristic somehow computes the swaps until it obtains the solution and counts the number of swaps. So from each configuration of the grid, it can determine how many swaps we may need. Example, in our current initial state, 9 is not at the first position because 7 is at its position, and this means we need to swap the 9 with the element whose target position 9 is taking. So in fact this means we have to actually swap 9 with 4. 9 is at the position where we want to have the 4 in the goal state. So now we swap this. In next test, we test again. 9 is still not in the first position. Now we swap it with the element whose target position and for the goal state it takes. So 9 actually takes the position of 2. We swap it. Actually, 9 occupies the position of 1. So we actually swap it with 1. And this brings 9 to the end of our string, because the 1 is in the end. So let me repeat this and make this a little bit clearer again. So in the first number, 9 is at the position where the 4 should be. So we switch the two numbers. Then this brings 9 a little bit forward, but now it's in the position where 2 should be. So we switch again. So we swap them again. So now 9 is in the position where the 1 should be, but it's still not at the first position. So we switch now 9 and 1. Now it's in the position where the A should be, and so on and so forth. In total, we need 8 swaps under this heuristic to transform the current initial state to the target state. So our heuristic estimate is 8. So here we have seen that for a single game, we can actually compute quite a number of different heuristics. So on slide 47, let's look into a general techniques, how we can derive heuristics when we have given a white box description. So for example, let's assume we have in the end puzzle, we have an explicit description of a move. We have given some preconditions and we also have the effects. So we use predicates to describe the action. So we have a predicate on T, Y, means tile T is on cell Y. We have a predicate clear Y, which means cell Y is clear of tiles, and we have the predicate adjacent YZ, which means that cell Y is adjacent to cell Z. Now, when can we actually move a tile Y or tile T from a cell Y to a cell Z? So, as a precondition, the tile Y must be on the cell T. The position where we want to move it, Z, must be clear. Furthermore, we can only make adjacent moves. So in each move, we shift a tile to the next cell. So if these three conditions are satisfied, so the target position is clear and it's next to our current position, then our tile will be in this new position Z. Y becomes clear. Our tile will no longer in position be in cell T, in cell Y, and the new position or the new cell of our tile will also not be clear anymore. And now we can actually very systematically remove certain elements of our action description and obtain the three heuristics that we have seen. So for example, if we remove clear Z and adjacent YZ, then we get the misplaced tile heuristic. So we don't care whether the target position is clear, we don't care where it is, we just say it's the current position and we move it to the new position. If we remove this condition on the target position being clear, we obtain the Manhattan heuristic, and when we do not care about the adjacency of the two positions, we obtain Gaschnik's heuristics. So later in this lecture, when we talk about AI planning, we will use these ideas to very systematically derive very powerful heuristics. Finally, we can also use so-called pattern databases. We can apply the divide and conquer principle. So we decompose our problem into subproblems. So from a goal, we can derive subgoals. We store solutions to these subproblems with associated costs. We call this patterns. And then we use these solutions. And this also helps us to, in fact, reduce our search effort significantly. So, for example, if we look at larger instances of the puzzle, here we see the 15th puzzle, we can actually divide this into the 8th puzzle and to a so-called French. So we map then the current location of the fringe tiles into an index of a database. The database tells us the minimal number of moves to achieve the fringe. So then we first try to achieve the fringe and then solve the remaining 8 puzzle. A very famous example of this technique are endgame libraries in chess. So we try to extract subproblems, and for these subproblems we use then pre-computed, very effective solutions that take us then to the goal. On slide 49, we also summarize some of the techniques how we can actually learn heuristic functions. So we've already seen that we drop some conditions on our problem description and sometimes also consider relaxed problems. So for example, we do not require that two tiles must be in adjacent positions. And if we have a problem with fewer restrictions on an action, then we call this a relaxed problem. And the cost of an optimal solution path to a relaxed problem is an admissible heuristic for the original problem. In fact, Gaschnik's heuristic is an example of such a so-called relaxed problem heuristic. And as the problem has fewer restrictions on the actions, it's also easier to compute an optimal solution path. Remember that we want our heuristics to be much more easier to compute than to solve the original problem. Modern search algorithms actually always analyze the domain and a given problem instance and then learn very problem and instance specific heuristics before they even start searching. So this allows them to scale much, much further. So with this, we come to the end of this lecture. Let me summarize what we looked at. We looked at heuristic search as a preferred method to search medium-sized search spaces. We learned how to how heuristics are defined and that they have very specific properties that we want to in a heuristic to satisfy. The effectiveness of a heuristic actually depends on these properties. We want the heuristic to be efficient to compute. We want it to be informative, so give us a good estimate of the distance to the goal, and it should be admissible and consistent. In particular, consistent heuristics play a very important role because they often guarantee the optimality of search algorithms. Very recently, bidirectional search has gained some attraction, so we can now guarantee that actually bidirectional search algorithms can meet in the middle, but we do not have yet any better optimization guarantees on the costs of these algorithms. Some improvements of bidirectional search algorithms have also been published recently, but this remains an active area of research. Greedy best first search is nevertheless also an important algorithm because it helps us to find good solutions quickly. Finding good heuristics can be done by analyzing the search problem, for example, by using relaxation methods. And of course, not to forget that A-star is optimal on graphs when it uses consistent heuristics. Finally, let's go through the summary questions. You should be able to explain the underlying ideas of greedy best first search, A-star, and iterative defining A-star. You should also be able to explain the properties of A-star. Why can iterative deepening A-star be more efficient than A-star in practice? Look here at the two search strategies that these algorithms use. Can you explain heuristics? Can you explain what role they play in informed search and how we can develop good heuristics or what properties we require from good heuristics? We also defined the properties of admissibility and consistency for heuristic functions. Can you explain these two properties? Do you know what happens if a star is working with a non-consistent or a non-admissible heuristic? How does this affect, for example, cost guarantees on a solution? And can you explain the basic ideas of bidirectional search and what is an important property for this type of search algorithm to work? Thank you very much. And with this, we end the lecture on heuristic and informed search.